First of all, let me say personally that Dr. Chhabra is one of my personal favorite homeopaths. We had the good fortune a few years back to actually sponsor a seminar of hers, a five-day seminar in Virginia, and I was incredibly impressed with that seminar, both in terms of her knowledge of homeopathy, her skills as a prescriber, and her ability to communicate her knowledge and her skills and her talent to those in the audience. I remember at the very end of the seminar, literally she had, it was like a rock concert. People were just standing up applauding, and I was waiting for people to pull out their lighters to light them like you would see at a, you know, Grateful Dead show, and it was quite impressive. Divya has been teaching homeopathy in India and abroad for the last 7 years. She's lectured throughout the world, including Switzerland, Germany, Austria, England, Ireland, Belgium, Holland, Greece, the Slovakia Republic, Australia, New Zealand, the United States, and Canada. She's conducted provings of several remedies, including Magnesia sulfurica, Thea, citrus, lactulinum, tungsten, lacte floratum, lacumanum, eagle, and she's even conducted some very interesting provings of polycrest remedies, including Calcarea carbonica and Natrium muriaticum, and I'm going to ask her some questions about that later because those are very interesting provings that she did in various potencies, and I think she'll inform us how that relates to actually various posology methods. She's an absolutely brilliant case taker, and she's developed a method which involves free association that allows the practitioner to get to the very depth of the case and to really find out what is that core delusion, what is that fundamental reason for the particular pathology of that person. And she's a master case taker, a master homeopath, somebody who we can all learn tremendously from. So, Divya, again, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kim.
Divya, I know that one of your really great strengths, as I mentioned just a moment ago, is your whole case-taking approach. And I thought perhaps you could give us some insight into what this approach is all about and how you developed it.
Well, I, like all other homeopaths, began by using symptoms, repertory, and repertorizing the case to come to the remedy. But then I found that every case does not respond even though you choose the rubrics with the same methodology. So the question was why. And then the realization that beyond just the rubrics or the mathematical totality, as Hahnemann says, lies a different totality of symptoms. This totality is the state of the case. This state, I realized, is expressed both at the level of the mind and the body. The state is behind the mind and the body and expresses through both as a means of cry for help. It is asking for the right remedy for the state to be cured. We all learn from our failures. And as I went on and used this approach, I began to realize that despite getting beyond the mathematical totality to the state of the case, there were still some cases that did not respond. On understanding and reanalyzing and re-case-taking those cases, I realized that not only is there a mathematical totality beyond which there is a state, but there is another state behind an apparent state that is in front of us, a hidden delusional reality which is coded to us in the case in front of us. And it is this hidden inner delusion that is reflected in the person's life, in every generality, as well as in every physical pathological complaint that he has. And the understanding that once you get to that inner reality, everything in the case, whether it be his mental state or his physical, must go with the correct simile, brought me to using techniques to get to this inner hidden state.
Divya, I love the story that you told at the seminar on Divya about how your teachers used to say that practicing homeopathy was like taking a shotgun and shooting it up into the air, and sometimes a duck would fly over and hit the bullet.
Yes, this is what would be happening to us in the initial part of the practice, that as our teacher said, that homeopathy would be like shooting a gun into the air, and just once in a while a bird would fly at the right spot and get the right remedy. And then we began to realize that That's not what we wanted to do, and that's not what Hahnemann wanted. And that there was something behind, there was some way that we could definitely get to the simulimum of the remedy. And every moment, that is what we are doing, which is perfecting the technique so that we are able to combine the art and the science of homeopathy. The art which is realizing that within or beyond the mathematical totality, beyond an apparent surface reality of the case, there is an inner story that the patient is living out constantly. We need to go beyond this outer story, the outer movie the patient has, into this inner state. And once we reach this inner state and repertorize the rubrics of that inner story, then we definitely reach the simulimum. And every gunshot will hit the right clay pigeon. And thus we would be able to live Hahnemann's reality, which is that every patient would reach the high ideal of cure, where he would live his life with freedom and with choice. For freedom and choice is health. And the moment we land ourselves in a situation where we say, I don't have a choice, we begin the story of our disease. And thus getting to that point where we can be the way we want and express our true potential. And the scientific methodology, the way that the case could be taken, the way the code that the patient says through his disease can be deciphered, so that without doubt at the end of a case, every homeopath could say, yes, I am sure this is the simulimum of the case. And doesn't need to say, let's see if it works, to know if it is the simulimum. And that is what we have been perfecting over time. And thus the use of a case receiving method, which is based on a spiral technique, where we go from the superficial outside story, spiraling within, using definite guidelines to pick the correct words that a patient says to guide us to that deeper inner story. Once we reach the inner story or part of that inner story, we pick again those key words and take that quantum leap into his unconscious, where he is free to live that out inner story. Because in life outside, our rationality, our intellect prevents us from living that inner story. Because we are prevented from living that inner story, it is expressed in our physical body as physical disease. But when we reach the unconscious, often when we ask about the childhood, also when we ask about the hobbies, this is where the patient is able to live his inner state, his inner story freely. And thus when we find the rubrics of those inner story words, we are able to get to the simulimum of the case. And through the seminars, it is my endeavor to show through the cases how you can, without doubt, and all of us can do it in the same manner, pick the correct words which the patient is pointing out, leading us to that inner story of the case.
You know, watching you do this actually in a seminar is really fascinating. One of the things I really appreciated about the seminar that you offered in Virginia was the fact that you would show live video cases, and it would really demonstrate exactly how this approach works. I know it's difficult in such a short time to do this, but could you give us an example of exactly how this would work, like what kind of words a patient would use and how you would actually take those words and free associate them to get to the inner core of the case?
I will do it through a simple case.
Okay.
This is a case that a man who was brought to me in a state of panic. And he described to me that I am completely panic-stricken. I am frightened. As he said frightened, his eyes widened. He said, with fright, I begin to sweat. And what was the reason for his fright was, now don't laugh, but he was just about to get married 2 days later. And he wanted to run away. He said, I want to escape. And thus the key words I would pick so far are panic, eyes wide, fright, sweating, wanting to escape. Because these were intense, spontaneous feelings he developed in a situation which was related to getting married. As I asked him a little more, he said, I feel I must escape for my survival depends on it. A peculiar word, or why would somebody's survival depend on running away from a marriage situation? This was a girl he had chosen himself. He had no problems with in the relationship until now, except that when it came to the point of getting married, he wanted to escape. It was beyond his understanding what was happening to him. As we traced his story backwards and we asked him, in which other situations in your life you've developed similar feelings? He described a feeling of fright every time he would have to appear for an exam or an interview. He said, I express and feel a similar feeling every time I have to change a job and go for an interview. Every time I've had to give an exam right from childhood, I've experienced the same trembling, perspiration. I want to escape from there. I am panic-stricken. He remembers an incident where in his school life, he was on stage for the first time and he completely froze with panic. He said, I began to sweat. I wanted to escape. I couldn't say a single word. My mouth was dry. I just wanted to run away from there. So in the technique, we noticed three key situations in his life. His marriage, exams, stage fright. And we hear that he uses the same words in these three situations, which is panic, which is eyes wide open, which is tremble, which is sweating, which is want to escape. And hence the first guideline to choose the word is words that repeat in different situations in a person's life. The second guideline is words that are peculiar. They are out of context. They are Hahnemann's peculiar, queer, rare and strange words. For example, if somebody says, I feel I will die if I don't run away from the marriage. This is a peculiar, spontaneous expression. Had he said, I'm not sure I can take the responsibility, this would be a normal premarital nerve situation. But for him, the delusional feeling was that as if he will die, as if he will not survive. And hence, the intensity of the panic. And thus the realization that once we've chosen words that repeat, once we've chosen words that are peculiar, where are these words coming from? If the words are repeating in different situations in a person's life, they cannot be related to the situation. They must be related to the person. And therefore, these words come from his inner story. The inner story finds an expression in the outer story to be able to come out and say, this is what I feel. And a very peculiar word, which makes you say, where did that come from, is the word that has slipped out of the unconscious. Very often, if you stop and ask the person, can you describe what do you mean you will die if you get married? He would say, no, that is the wrong word. The moment he says, no, that is the wrong word, you know it is the right word. Because it is his intellect telling you, his reason telling you, that this word is inappropriate in the situation of marriage. But it tells you that therefore this word must be appropriate somewhere to his inner story. And so we pick the words that are inappropriate in the outer story, but appropriate for that inner story for which we are going to find the remedy. The other key words we would choose are words where patient expresses both polarities. So he says survive and die. A situation, a different word where a person expresses a metaphor or a simile. I feel as if somebody is going to strangulate me. The word as if takes you immediately from the reality into the delusion, into the similarity, because he says, it is not as if somebody is strangling me, but I feel as if I am being strangled. And hence metaphors, similes where the person uses as if have to be picked up as codes to lead us to that inner story. The next is, patients often use source words. Source words are words that can be used in a physical expression. They can be used as an emotional expression, as well as they are used in the world around for some objects or action. For example, the word cut up. A patient, when he is emotionally hurt, could say, I felt cut up. In his physical problem, he has appendicitis. The doctor tells him, we have to cut you up. The third, cut up is a normal action used for objects in the world around. So such words we denote as source words, because they can take us from the outer story to the inner delusion, and perhaps actually to the source through which comes our remedy, our proving, and the symptomatology. So once we had picked these words in this above case of this man panic-stricken before marriage, I went from his conscious to the next level, the level between the conscious and the unconscious, which is the dream level, and asked him, so what is the dream that you get? And he said, whenever I am in a stressful situation, I get one kind of dream repeatedly, which clearly tells you that the subconscious is telling you this is the stress he actually feels from within, no matter what is happening to his life outside. And so we say, what's that dream? And he says, I am running in a jungle. It is dark. And why are you running? Because a wild animal is chasing after me. And what will happen? I will die. I will not survive. Here he has picked that peculiar word he used in his marriage situation and connected it to this inner story at the dream level. And then you say, what is the feeling? What will happen if this wild animal gets to you? And he says, the feeling is it will eat me up. And then we take all these words, take it, and we begin to free associate. So we tell the patient, say whatever comes to your mind. Don't think of what is possible. Don't think of what is happening in your life. Just take it beyond to a level which is something which has not happened, will not happen, cannot happen. In other words, take it away from your conscious reality. And as we use the same words we have picked, the patient begins to link them into another story. A story of a person lost in a jungle, dark, alone, frightened, sweating, mouth dry, and the feeling that at any moment a wild animal can come and gobble him up. And thus the remedy I prescribed for this person was not Medorhinum for fear of marriage, not Lycopodium, not Barita for fear of responsibility, not Floric Acid for wanting to break his relationship, because this is the superficial story. I gave him a single dose of Stramonium 1M, and everything settled. His panic, his scenario settled completely. He's married now very happily with 2 children who still come to me as a patient. And the reason to give Stramonium was the delusion that he is alone, lost in a jungle, that he will be devoured by wild animals, which is the key symptom of the Solanaceae family, of which Stramonium is a remedy. So this is how we trace from an outer story to the rest of his life, to his dreams, to his unconscious, and finally take the unconscious story rubrics to get to the remedy. We also understand remedies deeper, not only just through rubrics, but also filling the gaps of our materia medica through the study of family, because we have realized more and more that we need more remedies, more than perhaps our repertories and provings have been able to keep pace with. The world is changing rapidly, and hence we need to find tools where we can fill in these gaps, not replace, because nothing replaces a proving, but fill in the gaps until perhaps a proving can be done to corroborate our finding. And the tools that we thus use is understanding remedies in groups as families, then understanding the differences. Also using physics, chemistry, biology, botany, zoology, animal behavior, the world around, to understand the source of the remedies. Because we know that the source or the substance and its story in the world is linked to that inner state that the proving brings forth to us. And hence, one way to understand and fill in these gaps is to understand the source as it is, the families as they are, and of course the provings, newer provings, to be able to use remedies not prescribed before. Are you there, Kim?
Yes, I'm listening with I'm quite fascinated for me to listen to you describing it. But, you know, Divya, what I find so brilliant about your approach, and what not just brilliant but so essential, is the fact that you go to the depth of the case and you find really what is that fundamental disturbance. Because what you said before to me really struck me as being very true, especially in modern culture, because people are so they're so controlled and they put out a face that really isn't their true face. And frequently the story they tell you is not the true story. And if you try to prescribe on all of that, you frequently just don't give a remedy that has any effect in the case. And that's what I love about your approach, is that it gets to that core issue. And I think that's why you have such a good success in practice, and why your students are also able to emulate that success and have the same kind of success in their own practices. So I really want to acknowledge the tremendous work you're doing and the contribution you made to homeopathy. I think it's just really fantastic. I'm curious.
If I can just add something here, Kim.
Yes, yes, please.
Because
go ahead.
What you just said explains what many critics say today, that how is it that Hahnemann was able to cure people with the remedies like calcarea, lycopodium sulfur, and that we find the need for dramatic remedies like eagles or plutoniums or granites or things like that. And the reason is, as you said, that the world has changed to a point where people are not simply expressing what is within them, but they are covering it up, and they are unfortunately not covering it up consciously, but they are unconscious of their own cover or mask they use. And hence the levels and the kinds of diseases that we have today are deeper and deeper.
It's so, very true.
Yes.
Divya, you mentioned provings a moment ago, and I know you've done a lot of work in provings, and I've read some of your provings myself and been very impressed with the quality of them. I'm curious, what did you discover in all these provings that you've done as it relates to your methodology? And also, could you tell us a little bit about what your provings told you about the actual use of potency? Because I found that very interesting as well.
So I'd just like to say that the latest proving that we did was from the sea animal family. And I will be talking about that in detail at Texas, the family, as well as the proving that we have done, which is very interesting.
Okay,
but
good.
The whole process of doing the provings has, in effect, taught me everything about homeopathy. Because it is only when you take a single dose of a 30 of a remedy and see the complete change in your view of the world around that you can truly understand what is a delusion. It is only when you are constantly living that delusion and when you are acting it out in every aspect of your life and your physical symptoms are speaking that same inner story and you are experiencing it within yourself, can you truly understand that what Hahnemann said, that there is a state that expresses through the person, is so very true. It is when I experience that, not just once, but again and again and again, that I realized that is that story that we need to catch in every case. And that is what the provings taught us. As we took it one step further, the next landmark for me in my proving was when I did the lac felinum proving. The lac felinum proving, even when I think of it today, makes my hair stand up, because not only was it an intense proving that brought symptoms together, but it explained the very fundamental philosophy of homeopathy to me. For there were different situations that came up in the proving. Every prover dramatically expressed different reactions and situations. And yet, as we would trace them back to what their feelings were, it was interesting how about 80 different situations could come down to the same group of 10 feelings that every prover individually experienced, and we realized that it was common to all these provings, even though the provers did not meet each other, did not know what each other was proving. As we then found these common words and common feelings and took them deeper, it came down to a story and a word, which was prostitution. I still remember when we sat down and worked it, and we said, it all comes down eventually to a feeling of prostitution. And I said, well, what does that have to do with lac felinum or the cat? A colleague had just been to the British Council library and picked a book of people who had spent 3 years observing and filming the social life of a group of cats, non-homeopaths. And as they wrote the story of the cat and its life, in the chapter related to evolution, they had written that the cats evolved from the Egyptian wild cats. And then it further said that as man destroyed the wildlife habitation, food became scarce for these wild cats. And then they needed something for survival. The only food that was abundant was where the human race was living. And to get to this food, they had to become acceptable to the human being. For as a wild cat, they were feared they would be shot at sight. And hence, over the next few years, this wild cat became smaller. It domesticated itself, as the book said. It says the cat is the only animal that domesticated itself. And hence it did it. It lost its freedom, its wildness, and became a domesticated, tamed, small animal so that it could survive. And then I can still see those words in front of me where the authors had written, they had prostituted themselves for their survival. Was it worth it? And at this point, I realized that our provings are not just data. They're not just a beautiful story that links the data, but they are that hidden conflict of the source, of the substance within the world around us. And the provings are a magnificent way of being able to understand what is the conflict that substance has undergone in the world around in the process of evolution. And thus understanding this brings homeopathy to a different level, to understand every remedy as well as to understand every patient in front of us. And hence being able to connect the source to the delusional state, to the physical disease symptoms, to the mental expressions of the person in different realities of his life, is the beautiful process of homeopathy. And at the end of it all, you see, so now I understand why this person has developed a particular kind of gland where he has a particular kind of pain, and this is what that gland, that disease is telling us. And this is the substance and its remedy that can take it out from its root. And thus, proving is the methodology that has really taught me the different methods of case receiving and where are we going for in a case. To answer your next question, the one gray area that was very prevalent a few years ago in homeopathy was potency, because nobody was quite sure when we should give what potency. And at that point, we took the common remedy of Calcarea Carb and Natrum Mur in two different settings. The reason to choose these remedies are because they are well-proved remedies. And I wanted only one unknown entity, which is the potency. Different groups of people received 30, 200, 1M, 10M, 50M of the remedy. And their symptoms were then taken down. They were understood. And the gradation of what kind of symptomatology or how a person expresses his state in the appropriate potency has been worked out. And to the point that once I teach this or I have assistants who learn from me, 10 minutes down the case, we know the potency of the remedy, of the case. It takes us an hour and a half or two to get to the remedy, but the potency is very clear right in the beginning. So this is another aspect that I would like to describe in detail through cases and through the proving at the Texas seminar.
Well, you know, I really like that, Divya, because frequently when you go to a seminar and people describe remedies and you ask them, well, what potency, they'll say, it doesn't matter the potency. So it's very nice for there to be this scientific precision in terms of how to give the potency, and I really like the idea of coming at it through the provings. So to me, this is, again, a very brilliant way of, you know, really refining the way that we actually practice, because from my perspective, the similimum or the best remedy is not just the remedy but also the potency itself. So to me, this is extremely valuable for practice. I know we're running out of time here, and I was hoping you could just perhaps talk a little bit about the C family remedies. I know you're going to be talking about those in San Antonio, and could you give us a little bit of idea of what that's all about and anything about the remedies themselves? What are those remedies? What common themes you found? Anything that you can share with the group here?
The remedy that we proved, I let it be a little bit of a suspense so that it's fun for the people when they come and they watch what's happening.
Sure.
But we did one proving of a remedy, and then we had cases from other sea animal remedies, which are the stingray, which are Asticus, which is the hermit crab, and we took the existing provings as well as the cases and took the data together and then took the data that we got from the proving that we did. And it was amazing to see how very clearly you could, in all these different remedies, of course, sepia, find the symptoms that are clearly common to the group. For example, the feeling of heavy, intense heaviness is a theme that is common to the sea animals. A heavy dragging down that you know in sepia is not only a remedy, not only a symptom of sepia, but one of all the sea animals. And sepia being the best proved of them all, that's how we understand it better. The other opposite theme is a desire for lightness, for freedom, fun. For the sea animals all feel heavy, weighed down, and tied up by responsibility and guilt. And the need is to float, to be light, to be free and unencumbered, to be calm and peaceful like the blue waters. But yet, under these calm blue waters is another story. For within this is a very intense, competitive need for survival. The level of competition between the sea animals for their own survival is perhaps most intense, more than any other animal. And hence, they are constantly finding a way to beat the other and survive, or constantly finding a way to hide as a defense. This hiding, this particular kind of camouflage, puts a peculiar conflict. Every method of defense for survival that an animal uses puts its conflict within them, which is expressed in the proving. And so They hide as a defense, as a camouflage, which is often expressed in the proving as detachment. And yet this detachment creates its own set of problems, because they eventually get to the point of detachment from self, to the feeling of I'm not myself. And detachment from the world around as an escape, which leads to that peculiar indifference that we know so well within the sepia. They are also dependent. They feel dependent on groups often, and yet feel dominated and criticized, suffocated, and unable to express their feelings. A lot of them hide within shells or protective hard coverings, for they feel very vulnerable, very exposed to competition within their group, as well as to the predators that are just waiting to eat them up. The big fish eat the small fish story. The most interesting aspect of the sea animal, however, which is not found in any other group, is the question of gender roles. In all the sea animals and in the proving, it was beautifully brought up that the whole issue of gender roles is questioned in the sea animal, with the females reacting across a polarity of being highly dependent and oppressed on one side to actually assuming power and dominance. They often express power, the female expresses power in this family by sexual partner choice, which is expressed as indifference and repulsion on one side, or a very selectively increased desire on the other. There's also great protectiveness and guilt towards children, and also that polarity of letting go of the parental role to the male, like in the seahorse, where the female completely frees herself from this responsibility. And then each individual remedy within the group expresses a particular point of conflict within this broad general polarity that we see, moving from one point of the gender roles to the other. So this whole theme also explained why the female reproductive organs and male reproductive organs are the seat of attack by disease in the sea animals, you know, sepia, you know, murex. The key area which is often affected by them is the reproductive organ, because that is expressive of the emotional gender conflict within. So this is a remedy that perhaps this is a group which is very, very relevant to the world today. Because I think one issue that is constantly there in for the last decade, I think, and getting more and more intense, is the themes of gender roles and the themes of the conflict within these gender roles. And hence it's a family that really I enjoy teaching, and it brings across, it is something we can all relate to and touch at different points with our cases and our lives.
Hmm. Well,
but more about that.
I'm very looking forward to it. I'm going to be there myself, Divya, and I'm quite excited to hear what you have to say in full detail about these remedies, and also to see your wonderful cases as well. It is time to open up the call for the audience. Before I do that, though, let me just, for those of you who were not on at the beginning, let me just reiterate that Dr. Divya Chhabra will be coming to the United States and will be conducting a seminar called From the Beginning on December 1st through the 4th, 2005, in San Antonio, Texas. And for those of you who have not been to San Antonio, I've had the opportunity to go there a few times in the last couple of years, and it's a wonderful city. And this is a wonderful time to go to San Antonio. You can walk on the river. It's an area called the Riverwalk, and all the lights are up for Christmas, and it's just a wonderful place to take your family or have a short vacation and learn from one of the best homeopaths we have on the planet today. So if you want more information about this wonderful seminar, Divya does not come to the States very frequently. This is the only appearance this year in the States. So if you have an opportunity to go to San Antonio and study with her during this period of time, please take that opportunity. If you want more information, you can contact the Texas Institute of Homeopathy. The phone number is 210-492-3162. That's 210-492-3162. You can also visit their website at www.texashomeopathy.com. That's www.texashomeopathy.com. texashomeopathy.com. And again, this is a wonderful time in San Antonio, and I can guarantee you this will be a tremendously beneficial seminar, whether you're a student or a practitioner. If you're new to Divya's work, it's probably the best seminar to go to, as she will be discussing her methodology from the beginning in full detail. And if you're one of her seasoned followers, it's also quite valuable. You can never get enough of Divya, as far as I'm concerned. So, again, Divya, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm going to unmute the line and let some other people ask some questions.
Well, Divya, I actually wanted to know that recently I started using these alum potencies, and I found that after using this C200 and all, and if you give alum potency, sometimes it starts reacting like a proving and what. So is it sometimes do you give, because I have a child who actually responds very well to alum potency, but I gave first the C200 glycopodium and then gave him alum potency. So he started having some, like, he's seeing images and all that after starting the alum potency. So is there any indication that don't mix the two, like C200?
So in my experience, Krishna, I would give the LM potency when I have given a C potency, a centesimal scale or a remedy, and I find that every time the patient comes, although he's better, his state keeps repeating. Every time you talk to this person, he still very intensely repeats his state words again and again and again, even though he's better. So the first reaction would be, repeat the remedy more frequently. But then as we realize that there comes a need to repeat the remedy more frequently for such people, then we go to Hahnemann's next step, which is when you need to repeat the remedy more frequently, it is better not to repeat it in the same potency, but to deviate it. And thus, in such cases, I would then give an LM potency. However, I have found that if your remedy is not the exact similimum and is just a partially similar remedy and you give the LM, it will always cause an aggravation or will bring out some symptoms that seem like proving symptoms. And hence, it is almost another guideline almost to know whether you have come to the absolute similimum of the case or you are very close. And hence, LM is to be used only when one is very sure that the remedy is life, right, because otherwise it definitely causes an aggravation. I also use it for cases of malignancies and cases of very deep pathologies where the vitality is low and needs to be brought up gradually to the level where perhaps later they may accept the centesimal dose. Does that answer your question, Krishna?
That was a very good answer, Divya. Let me ask somebody else to ask a question. Anybody else have another question?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
What about the bird flu? Any ideas?
I would deal with the bird flu like any other epidemic, which is that at first if you get cases that come to you of having that disease or symptom, I would individualize every case and take the state as it is, see whether it is the constitutional state of the person, or else give them the remedy that the state at that moment needs. As you see more cases, you would begin to see if there is a common aspect of that state that is beginning to repeat in many people, which means that some of your existing patients may still need their constitutional remedy, but others would show an altered state. And when many people would show the same kind of altered state, then you would find the genus epidemicus for that particular epidemic and be able to cure it. And hence, pooling in the information if people have different cases at this point would be very beneficial to be able to find a genus epidemic. As far as preventive goes, if a patient is on his similimum and his immunity has not dropped due to some intense situation in his life,
I would feel that most of our patients would be very well protected from this bird flu, and I would not worry. If they would call us in a panic and say, now what about this? It means they are in the state where they could get affected because their immunity is shaken. Call them in and see if they require a repetition of their constitutional remedy to bring their immunity up. But the constitutional remedy is the best form of preventive medicine that we have in homeopathy.
Do you have anything in print on potency on the subject matter?
I have a chart on potency prescribing, which I would give out at the seminars. I could email it to you if you like. If you just email Joy at Texas, I can email it to you. But it is the book that I am publishing, which has all my matter in terms of families, the technique, and potency is still to be in print.
Okay. Yeah, we'll have the potency charts at the seminar, Divya.
Yes, we will.
For everyone who attends, we'll have the potency chart.
That's right.
What's the title of the book?
You tell me what I should title the book. It's books, actually. So I let me just write them, and we'll title them after that.
Okay.
May I ask you, do you have emails that I can email you my question? Because my last question about natrum muriaticum, unexpected aggravation that I got from the patient, getting half an hour later cold, very icy cold hands and feet. Keeping
is that Catherine?
Pardon?
Is that Catherine? Are you?
No, it is another person.
Ah, okay, yes. And icy coldness of the hands, go on.
Hands, yeah. And feet. Half an hour after taking 200, one single dose of 200 natrum muriaticum.
The first I would find out is if this person is an idiosyncratic person, does he react very often to remedies? Or else I would try and see whether the potency of the remedy was perhaps a little higher than the person required. But if he settled after that, it would just be a homeopathic aggravation, and he should start getting better after that. The most important thing at such a situation is to be sure that you know you have given the similimum. Once you know that, it is either the potency or just a homeopathic aggravation, and it will tide over. But if you are not sure of the remedy, then it is a good point to retake the case and be sure that you've given the right remedy in this case.
Fantastic, Divya. So we are out of time. Let me just reiterate again that Divya will be coming to San Antonio. It's the only time she'll be coming to the States, December 1st through the 4th of this year. If you want more information, you can call the Texas Institute of Homeopathy at 210.
Kim, I'd like to add one sentence.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That I'll
go ahead.
Be emphasizing one aspect of homeopathy, which is the confluence point, which is the end point of case taking, and the one that if you reach, you definitely get to the similimum of the case, and that's the confluence point of the case. So, Kim, you can take it from there.
you have so much to share. I can't wait to come to Texas to hear it all. So, again, just to reiterate, if you're interested in getting more information about Divya's seminar in San Antonio, a beautiful city, well worth visiting, please call the Texas Institute at 210-492-3162, or you can visit her website at www.texashomeopathy.com. I'm going to unmute the lines, and please let's give Divya a big thank you for taking the time to join us for this call. It's early in the morning. She's got a busy schedule. She's writing lots of books, doing lots of provings, and we really appreciate all she does for homeopathy.